Welcome to the Grinders Table, the podcast where we sit with C-suite executives and founders who are taking their industry by storm to figure out how you can build an exceptional career and business. Together, we'll try to uncover how they have both defined the odds and what you can learn from their experience. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Grinders Table podcast. And today we have somebody special on the table. And in my usual fashion, I'm going to allow her introduce herself. So, June, over to you.
Hi, Owen. It's a pleasure to be here. So a little bit about me. I grew up in a place called Yaba in Lagos, which a lot of people don't realize, but I guess I've been here since I was 17. So my airport accent confuses people a lot. But yeah, I came over to study, as happens, you know, you either get shipped off to America or to London. And I had family here. So London was the choice for me, and it was a bit closer to home. So I wanted to have the option to be able to get to Lagos quickly if I missed my Yaba. So yeah, I went to UCL, studied economics. And my first career began at Thomson Financial, and very quickly, within a few months of me joining, became Thomson Reuters. So I ended up in a news company. I worked on the news floor covering syndicated loans. I kept trying to get over to the entertainment side. They wouldn't let me, but I hung out there a lot. And then, yeah, a couple years in, I got a call from a recruiter saying that there was this American bank coming to the UK, and they were setting up shop, and they were looking for happy people. And I have to say that call has stuck with me for many years, because I just thought that was a fabulous way to entice me, because I love joy. If anyone who knows me knows that I'm forever giggling, and the idea of working with awesome, fun people was very enticing. So yeah, I joined Silicon Valley Bank in 2011. It was their venture debt team, and they were in the process of setting up their commercial banking practice. So I joined at a very, very, very exciting time. It was all guns blazing, all hands on deck, and I had to learn very fast. I didn't come from a background of banking. So very quickly I had to understand all the different bits about compliance, which, you know, they didn't teach us in our economics class. And, but also just how fast paced the world of startups was. I had to very quickly learn the whole vocabulary around venture debt and venture capital and, you know, what a good startup looks like. And also, you know, what happens when companies run into trouble with not being able to finance their debt, and sort of all the different metrics that go along with taking large amounts of money from a bank and needing to pay it back, making sure they're on track. So that was a very exciting period for me. The first deal I worked on was Farfetch. And then on my second maternity leave, it was actually the first mat leave at SVB, which was all fun and games. When you're the first. But yeah, when I came back, joined the early stage banking team, which was starting to work with much earlier stage startups, as SVB's plan was to become, you know, at the heart of the ecosystem and the sort of at the center. So that was really fun, trying to set that up, and really plugging in to the right companies and getting them into, you know, fully embedded in SVB and all our different offerings, which we were creating on the fly, which is super interesting. And yeah, it was, you know, second mat leave, I decided I wanted to see what it was like to build myself, and very quickly realized how expensive developers are and how little I understood about technical processes. So that really inspired me to begin my journey trying to understand a bit more about coding, and took a couple classes online with a two-month-old on my lap, as you do, and very quickly realized that I really wanted to be in a classroom environment, but there wasn't anything out there. So I set up the first child-friendly coding school for moms, and it was called Mums in Tech. And in summary, it was, they would go into tech companies and convert their meeting rooms into a classroom and a creche. And very much like Mary Poppins, we'd have nannies on site, and I would go around with my bag of toys for the babies. And, you know, I spent my time, actually gave myself 4 months to figure out how I was going to do this and, you know, develop a curriculum and figure out who was going to help me teach, and somehow convinced SVB to give me a small grant to cover childcare for the pilot program, which I ended up carrying on and leaving my job and running for 3 years. And it was on that journey, trying to figure out a business model that was going to work for Mums in Tech, and really struggling with figuring out the right type of capital, you know, feeling very frustrated, that and also meeting many founders along the way who were struggling with the same thing, that I decided actually that I was going to become a venture capitalist myself and see if I could solve the problem from the inside. And that's how I joined Samos in 2018. So I wear a lot of hats, you know, working on the European side at Samos and investing from pre-seed to early Series A, invested in, probably close to 20 companies in the last 5 years. And then also the last year and a half started investing across Africa, mainly thanks to a Google trip in 2019. I'm going to have to give Marta and Anthony, for those who don't know them, they are amazing. And yeah, they took us to Lagos, and it was great to be back and in the heart of what was, you know, very exciting startup ecosystem, you know, at the Google Accelerator program. And yeah, that was the year that Piggy Vest presented, and Odun really blew us away. I'll stop there because I'm speaking quite a lot.
You do have to stop because there's so much to unpack. So much to unpack.
Let's do it. Let's unpack.
We don't have all day, but I love how you took us on this chronological journey, and how each phase of your life influenced the next phase. Because oftentimes, and I tell people that, I mean, your life is a combination of those micro moments, or those, you know, those little moments that you're doing, either you're working or you're building a company. In the end, what your purpose is all those little things you've been doing in the past. Now you had to make a big switch, right? From Nigeria to the UK. And at different times, you had to also, you know, have this mind shift because you're entering a new industry. What cultural or, you know, general mind shifts have helped you navigate your life?
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to lie. At lunchtime, when suggestions are made for us to go get a sandwich, that's when I'm like, this would never happen if I worked in Nigeria. My husband knows as well. I don't do sandwiches. I am a rice person. And if I had my way, I would be in a bukka every lunchtime. Actually, for people, fun fact, I actually went to staff school when I was younger, primary school, and Unilag had an incredible bukka. We weren't really meant to go there, but we did. We found a way. And on my break, I would sneak out and I'd go and get my rice and bukka stew. So I think that was tough, you know, the food options. But you know, on a serious note, I think there is a, I feel like in Nigeria, there is such a massive hustle culture. We are incredibly adaptive. I think if anything, I struggled with some sense of the formalities, just because I'm, you know, my family is very entrepreneurial. I grew up, you know, just watching them innovate, you know, building out the supermarkets and building, you know, the Silverbird Galleria. So I saw how, you know, you can get things done really quickly. And I think stepping into a corporate environment, I struggled with just, you know, bureaucracy. I am a doer. I like to get things done really quickly. I think I'm happy to be scrappy. I always say to people that I'm definitely great at like the very early stages. I think this is why I love early stage investing. Because I want to be like stuck in. I want to help, founders, you know, with their problems at that stage, you know, whether it's, you know, helping them go on a hunt to find the right team members or just doing strategy sessions with them. That problem solving is just, it gives me so much energy. And I think if anything, that's the Nigerian side of me coming out where it's like, we'll figure it out, you know, back home, NEPA goes like, we'll figure it out. It's okay. You know, we'll get over it. I think I don't get phased very easily. And I tell my husband all the time, it's like, look, we went for days. I remember once the generator just, they could not fix it. And, you know, we just had to like get on with it. You know, you knew that you'd come home and, you know, the power would go out every hour for a while. You'd get bits of light. So you kind of just learn to adapt. And there were times where there would be no water. I mean, every African has probably experienced this at some point. And, you know, you have your big bucket of water that you just learn to work with. And this happens to everyone, you know, at some point. So I think that adaptability has really helped me, just not get very phased by a lot of things that people might consider a big deal. I'm like, it's okay. We'll figure it out. I'm that person who, I was like, I'll figure it out with you. Don't worry. Don't stress.
And being, you know, that go-getter and being that very scrappy person, how do you manage to motivate the people around you to go on that journey with you? Because one of the biggest frustrations with being a doer or, you know, or a hustler is, you know, people not necessarily understanding what you're trying to achieve, or they're not, you don't have the same energy. And it can be very frustrating for doers. I see founders complain about it, where they're saying they don't just get why people don't see the problem, or they don't get why people don't see how they're trying to solve the problem. How do you manage that? I mean, when you're in the vibe to get things done, how do you, you know, get resources and everything to be on your side?
That is such a good question. And it is so true. My husband will testify, especially when he did not want to move house, and I made it happen. I got the estate agent in, and he valued our house, and we were moving very quickly after that. But you know what? It's hard. I think the important thing is, you know, when I think back to how I got people on board, and this is something I think about a lot, you know, coming into a corporate that is incredibly busy. You can imagine any of the biggest tech companies. This woman comes along with two babies and says, let me borrow your entire technology team, for 3 hours a day, once a week. Oh, but in the middle of the day between 10 and 1, I still think back and say, why did they say yes to me and not say, please go? this is not the best use of our time. And actually, I think the reason is very simple. And I think every leader has the same, question they have to answer, but it's around the mission. It's around the purpose. You know, when I think back, it wasn't about me. You know, I was trying to create a space where women could come, learn about technology, be inspired. You know, we have this massive shortage of women participating in technology. We know this, you know, it's exactly the same problem for female founders. But, you know, things can never change unless people are very intentional about how they choose to spend their time and their resources. And I think I came along and I really tried to explain. And, you know, I didn't do any fancy presentations, if I'm being very honest. But I think people saw that the mission was bigger than me, and there were key people that heard, and it, you know, it touched some part of them, and they felt that they wanted to help me make this happen. And I think I've been very lucky in that I've been able to speak to the right people at the right time who made things possible. I don't know if there's any other way of describing it. But I was very lucky. I was very lucky. But I think, you know, people can be lucky and still not grasp the opportunity. I think there was also a certain level of confidence I felt because I just knew the problem was just so big. And I was like, look, we need to try something. It's not a perfect solution by any means. I was not a professional program developer. I was not a professional course runner, whatever you want to call it, but I just felt I had to try it. And I was very transparent about it. And I think there was a sense of humility that, you know, I'm not perfect, but I feel that this is something that I want to give a go. And I would be honored if people gave me their time and their resources to enable us help a couple of people.
You know, one word that comes to mind when you're speaking is audacity. And I remember watching the Kanye documentary, and everything I screamed about Kanye was audacity, like audacity to say, hey,
yeah,
switch from being a producer to a musician. And I kind of see that play out in life. Now, if we are being real and being honest here, sometimes your audacity has limits. Right? You can dream big. You can, you know, pitch very well. You can, you know, have the best networks, which we're going to talk about later, but still things don't just go your way. How do you, for yourself, again, this question is personal to you. How do you keep on pushing yourself or motivating yourself or telling yourself, I can still get this done?
Yeah, honestly, I think again, we don't talk about failures enough, and the whole journey has not been smooth. I think that's something I try to be as transparent as possible. I'd say that, you know, towards the end of running Mums in Tech, it was very hard for me to talk about what wasn't working. But, you know, on reflection, the business model, we just didn't get it right. And I think when I look back, it was a combination of, you know, me just wanting that service to remain very affordable. I think in an ideal world, I needed to be Oprah and just be able to provide that service for free. But, you know, my reality meant that I needed to have some source of income coming in. So that was a massive disappointment when I finally had to accept that I wasn't going to be able to carry on. But it really forced me to think and go deeper as to what I felt my purpose was and what I was truly trying to solve for. And you know, at the heart of it, it was giving more opportunities to people who just couldn't get through the door. So my thing has always been about breaking down barriers. This is like, you know, it's been my strapline ever since I was doing Mums in Tech. And I came up with it one day and I realized actually this sentence just means so much to me. And I sort of had it pinned up somewhere. And the more I thought about it, I was like, okay, breaking down barriers to what? And then I was like, ah, you know what? It's capital. It's breaking down barriers to like feeling confident. There's so many different layers. And I kept thinking, okay, well, where is an opportunity now? What can I actually do right now to still make a difference? And, you know, a bit of soul searching, and I realized actually by providing capital, you're solving so many of those layers because you're enabling some of these big problems to be solved at scale. And I think this is the beauty of technology. This is why I'm so excited about technology. So I think, you know, finding the courage to sit with yourself and accept that, yes, one door closes, but actually if that door hadn't closed, the next amazing door would not have opened. You wouldn't have seen it. You'd have been in your comfort zone, plodding along, just, you know, thinking everything is okay. But actually, what if there was one next step, another step that you were meant to climb that gets you to make more impact? And you're right. There are many things that don't go right at the time. You know, it doesn't always feel straightforward. It's uncomfortable. Coming into venture, I did not know if I was going to be any good at it. So there's a risk, a reputational risk as well you take, because you have to learn fast, you have to grow your network fast. But you also feel that huge sense of responsibility, at least I did, when I first got into venture capital, thinking, my goodness, how am I going to make a meaningful impact, especially if I'm still not in a position where, you know, I have the final say. I didn't join as a partner. You know, I came in as an investment manager. So I had to work my way up. And it was intense. It was intense, if I'm being very honest. 5 years in, I feel like I'm starting to know what I'm doing. But, you know, it takes time. And we put ourselves in, you know, under a lot of pressure to make a difference from day one. And, you know, trying to change an industry that has been a certain way for a very long time is no small feat. And I think it's strength in numbers. I think we're in a much better position now with more diversity, you know, the check writing level than before. So we're getting there. And, you know, another layer of transparency is, you know, as I ran the syndicate, I was thinking, well, can I turn this into a fund? And, you know, that didn't work out. It was a very tough fundraising environment last year. Like, you know, there is no going in halfway. You kind of have to put yourself out there and test the waters. And when you don't get the outcome that you were hoping for, that's tough. But then it does force you to go back to the drawing board and then, you know, sort of reevaluate how you continue on that mission, making impact and, you know, doing the thing that you love.
One of the things, in short, in everything you said, it's quite obvious that you're very passionate about female founders and diversity. What is one, and I know you have many, but what is one popular opinion that you think is entirely wrong about female founders or, you know, diverse founders?
That they're not ambitious. I think that is the thing I hear the most. And I think it's just so not true. And I think the hardest thing is walking into a room and someone's already made up their mind about you. So I guess the question is, how do we tell better stories about, you know, people who are absolutely killing it in their industries? I think there's a big role that media has to play, you know, write more books about these incredible. I love that there were some documentaries made last year about some of the great founders that have come from the continent. People need to hear these stories. They need to hear the genesis stories. They need to understand where people came from and where they are today. And it just is a little bit harder on the continent because of all the headwinds that every founder has to face, by no fault of their own. But it's just that we are not yet in a position where the infrastructure works for us, the policies work for us. That's sort of still work in progress. But I think people forget how early the venture ecosystem is. But I do not feel that means that people are not ambitious. They're just working with what they have.
Okay. I'm just going to ask something related to, I'll call it an elephant in the room among most investors, and people don't really like talk about it. Now, we say that not much capital is being allocated to, you know, Black founders or African founders or female founders. But you find that in these investment committees, you also have female LPs or female investors. So how come there aren't more capital going to these female founders when the decision makers sometimes are women?
And that's a fair question. You're right. It is an important question. And, you know, I think you still have to ask, even though they're in the room, it's still a game of numbers. If they're not, ultimately, larger than, I guess, the majority who would be making these decisions primarily, then we still are in the same position as we were before. But I think it's so important to remember that the bar should never be shifted because we are talking about a diverse founder, whether it be an African founder or a female founder. You know, none of that should mean that you approach the investment with a different lens, because I think nobody's advocating for companies that are of a lower quality to get through investment committee. So maybe the question to ask is, how are these companies sort of being presented? You know, are they actually venture backable businesses? And have they done the work? We know that a lot of drama happened last year. And I think, unfortunately, you go back and you dig and you ask the questions, and a lot of the companies just did not do the work beforehand. And really, they shouldn't have even gotten capital. We're finding companies not presenting the right financial information, just certain firms not asking the right questions. I think we should never lower the bar in order to get capital into companies. I think that's not what we want. We want incredible businesses that will be for the long term actually getting the money. I think that has to be the goal. And I just feel like, you know, it's the same way we would operate here with our European investments. We would ask exactly, and this is what we should want, exactly the same questions being asked across the board, same process, and we would hope for the same amount of fairness being applied to all founders.
Absolutely agreed. Now you had to move, you know, different industries, different companies, and you've literally been on a lifelong journey of learning. But what is one thing you always wanted to learn or do and you haven't had the opportunity to do yet?
I need to learn to swim again.
Me too.
This is embarrassing. I'm so happy. It's bad. It's bad. I can't swim. I remember going for millions of swimming lessons at a Curry Club and I failed woefully and I still can't swim. So that is the one thing I really need to learn before I'm 40. So I've got a few months to go. I'm working on it.
But you're a super networker. I mean, the rooms that I see you in, amazing. Now, is there any tip or anything you can share with the listeners on how you can get yourself in the right rooms, how you can network with the right people, how you can grow your network over time to get you to the destination that you want to go to?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And, you know, I think to maybe even to set some context, in 2011, when I was at SVB, I was bitterly shy. Oh my goodness. I was that person in the room who would not put up my hand, even if I knew exactly the answer. I was so, so, so shy. And, I also did not have Twitter, well, or X as they call it now, or I barely used LinkedIn, so really did not have any network. And I tell you what really helped me, complete authenticity. I think the first tip is be yourself. Like, do not feel you have to change or put up an appearance to try and impress anyone. I will talk to, you know, a Swiss banker, an LP, my friends, exactly the same way. I'm not going to change it for anyone. And that way you can show up as the best version of yourself because you're consistent. So that's the first thing I would say. People love just be yourself, because I think one thing we forget, there is actually no one like us. We don't have to try. Just be yourself. Like, there's something special about you. Tell your story. I never go into the room trying to be transactional. That is something, you know, I would always say, try and get to know people for people. And, you know, people love that. I actually have been to a couple of events, it's a company called HubDot. And actually, when you walk into the room, you're not allowed to say what you do. And it's really just, you know, talking about, you know, your ideas, you know, sharing stories. And I really love that. I think there is something special because actually people, they're going to remember how you made them feel for much longer than actually what job you said you did. So I think if that's the first, that's like the first tip, but also, you know, there's so many mediums like podcasts are incredible ways to learn about people. But then, you know, how often do you actually follow up? You listen to a podcast, you know, and someone says something really interesting. Have you thought about going on LinkedIn, messaging them and saying, oh my goodness, I really loved what you said. ever have time for a coffee, if you ever have time for a Zoom, I would love to connect. I have done that and it works. And it's, but it comes from a place of authenticity because you have a genuine interest in what they have to say. And honestly, that is how I have built my relationships over time, through shared interest. That curiosity that I have has served me in growing my network. But it really is about wanting to spend time with interesting people where you're going to have interesting conversations, learn something. And I think that's what makes what we do so exciting. Like, you can learn from every conversation. So keep, you know, put yourself out of your comfort zone. Say yes to events where you're going to learn something new. Do your research, look up who's going to be there, find out about them. When you see them, ask them about what they're doing.
Yeah, the power of conversations. And I always tell people that there's so much you can learn from just talking to people or listening to people talk, right? And I guess, again, it's a skill that you have to hone over time. And thank you for sharing all those tips. What is one founder that you're most proud of? Or who's the one founder you're most proud of?
You're going to make me choose. That is hard. That is hard. I am proud of all my founders. But honestly, I think, how do I choose? They're all doing really awesome things.
Maybe you can add, what made you pick them?
Yeah, I think for me, you know, the founders that I've backed, whether it's, you know, as an angel investor or through the syndicate investing in Africa, you know, for me, it's really about that hustle. There is something so special about being in the room with someone who like just really, really, really wants to solve this problem. And I think, you know, I don't take that for granted, because building a business is very, very hard. I think as an investor, it is definitely something that, you know, we think about. What is going to make this person want to stay on the course for the next 10 years? And I think this is how we need to be thinking, because it is very hard to build a solid business, you know, in sort of less than 6-7 years. Like, it takes time. And I think anything that is worth building, you know, you got to do it well. You need to think about how you're really building value. And also, how is this person going to attract an incredible team? So that's kind of what I'm looking out for. So the people I've backed, they do have this special magnetism. They pull you into the conversation. They really are great storytellers. They are motivators. And, you know, you hear about how they talk about the teams they want to build. And it's just magic, because it's just very thoughtful. And I think that's what really excites me. Because I'm very passionate about culture. And I think, you know, with great teams, you have the best opportunity to really solve the problem over the long term, because they will work well, they will innovate together. And you know, when it gets tough, you know, they will encourage each other, because it will get tough at times. You know that the last few months have been tough from a funding perspective. And the teams that have not been built with the strongest foundations will struggle.
Well, you found a very political way not to answer my question, but we take that. In rounding off, thank you, June, for spending the last few minutes with us. But I always round off with one question. And so I call it the power, money, fame, pleasure framework. Now, I'd like you to rank them between power, money, fame, and pleasure. Which is most important? Which is the most important to you, and which is the least important to you, and why?
Ooh, this is hard. I love having fun. So I'm going to put pleasure on top, because I think it's important, quality of life. And, you know, just for well-being, I would put that first. I think people underestimate how important it is. And then, I would say money, because without money, as much as we don't want to admit it, you know, we're not able to sort of be agents of change. I always think of Oprah and all the amazing things she's done. And, you know, in an ideal world, there's so much good I'd love to do. And I think without money, it just makes it very hard to do a lot of these things. So money, definitely. Power, because you need to be able to influence for good, obviously, always for good. And then fame. Fame lasts. I think it's never really about me. It's, you know, how do we make sure that we're able to move things along that need to, but it's more about the greater good.
I wish I had a bell I could ring right now to celebrate your answer.
Did I get it right? I feel like for the moral compass, did I get it right?
There's no answer. I can tell you for a fact that everybody sort of views it in different ways for
them. Yeah. And
that's why I love the question, because at various stages of your life, you find out that certain things are more important than the others.
Absolutely. That's so true. That is so true. Because I guess you're right. Even with a bit of fame, you could use it to have a great platform and spread the good news.
Of course. And that's all we're all about.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. And
thank you.
Amazing. Well done on all the work that you do. And trust me, the impact of the work that you have done and you're still doing is going to be felt years beyond your time.
Amen.
Have a great day.
Thanks, Uwem.
That's all on today's episode of The Grinders Table, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Monsieur Uwem. That's at Monsieur for Mr. in French, Uwem. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.